Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers. Someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers. Someone to care.
Johnny Cash, Your Own Personal Jesus. It's by way of introduction, a selection of Rick Miller, our guest on Sunday night, along with Beth Cates and Ben Chasson. And they're responsible for a show in Sydney at the moment called Bigger Than Jesus. It's part of the Sydney Festival. Bigger Than Jesus takes a satirical look at the religion we call Christianity, and more particularly the institution known as the Church. Rick Miller's one-man performance, framed as a celebration of the Eucharist, is at once funny, challenging, and to some, perhaps, shocking. Created by Rick and Richard Brooks, the show has been translated and performed in four languages around the world. Rick Miller, Ben Chasson, and Beth Cates, welcome to Sunday Night.
Hello, John.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. Rick, the obvious first question is, why Jesus?
I should add quickly that Daniel Brooks was the co-creator, and I, of course,
what did I say?
Miller, you said Richard.
I said Richard. Right. I'm sorry, Daniel.
It's all right. There. Why Jesus? Well, when we created this play 8 years ago or so, I was playing Jesus in Jesus Christ Superstar, fascinated with the role of Jesus as a rock star. I also knew the entire Catholic liturgy, the Mass, by heart, and I really hadn't been to a church in many, many years. And George Bush was in power at the time, talking about how Jesus was influencing his geopolitical decisions. And I figured there's something here that we need to tackle. And I was approaching the age of Jesus, you know, the age of 33, or that the mythical age, I suppose. And I approached Daniel first, and then Beth and Ben, and we embarked on this strange journey.
Beth, you're somebody who looked at this from outside, and what made you say, okay, this is worth working with, there's some ideas here that are fun, because you've actually taken responsibility for sort of putting some creative shape around the script, haven't you?
Yeah, that's what Ben and I brought to the project, and it actually stemmed from Rick and I working together for years on MacHomer. And so we had an existing creative relationship, and this came up.
And with Homer Simpson, you are dealing with one of the other great iconic Absolutely. Figures of our civilization, aren't you?
From one to the other makes perfect sense to us.
Yes, well, and Homer might be bigger than Jesus now, as opposed to
at the moment. Yes.
Yeah,
at the
yeah.
Their second album, wasn't it?
So it just came out of this creative relationship that we already had established, and as a Jew, this was all really interesting stuff, because as Jews, which Daniel is as well, we have a very different relationship to Jesus. So it was all really intriguing.
It also came at a time when technology was giving you vast new fields to work in. That is, you had the opportunity, Ben, to actually exploit the way new technologies, miniaturized, could really work in a theater.
Yeah, absolutely. And we approached it like the camera is the eye of God, and very blatantly, we use a triangle-shaped flying apparatus to put a camera in, very much like the American dollar bill with the pyramid and the pyramid. And God we trusted.
God's eye.
Yeah, exactly. Always here. Always here. And it speaks to always being watched in this. In a more modern society, we are always constantly being watched.
Does it have some particular relevance in Britain at the moment, where I believe there's more sort of spy-in-the-sky cams than anywhere else on the planet, if you're walking around London?
Yeah, so we've heard
the CCTV cameras, yeah. And there's a lot of talk of civil liberties and all, but, you know, we're trying to draw a parallel between that, you know, that metaphor of the sort of ubiquitous eye. And I, having grown up Catholic, you know, that was part of the doctrine and the teaching, was that, you know, just like Santa Claus, really, you know. So you better be good.
Let's talk for a moment about the way the design fits for the play and what makes it work from your perspective, Beth.
Sure. Well, a big part of what you see as the finished product comes from us making the show, all four of us, Daniel, Rick, Ben, and I, together on stage. So the design came to life as the text did, and everything informed everything else. So ideas would come up and scenes would be written, and then we would go away and figure out how do we make this camera fly? How do we put it in this box and make it invisible? How do we make Jesus appear? All these things. So we started with literally this blank slate of the white floor and the white screen and the flying camera, not much else. And so then over 3 weeks together, upstairs and downstairs, we made this piece. We crafted this piece. So everything is integrated. Everything is linked together. You start pulling one bit out and the house of cards starts to crumble a little bit.
Ben, at any time did you say, sorry, that's not going to work? You can't do that?
There was a brief moment where we talked about blood falling into the sand.
And flying, Rick.
And Rick was going to fly for a little while there. There was a few choices that we had to not just budgetarily, but logistically figure out.
And probably aesthetically, that works too, because if you stretch it too far, you lose that intimacy, don't you?
We also were fortunate enough to sort of give it a go 3 times before we did our quote-unquote world premiere. So there are things that Jesus does now. He doesn't sing from HMS Pinafore like he once did. He doesn't dance and spin his robe.
He doesn't do a talk show anymore.
No.
He doesn't have a tour with recorded video of walking around in Las Vegas. We've evolved.
And Daniel is tremendous at crafting the moment and helping designers. And like, he's really got a tremendous eye for balance and what's right and what's not. And I remember him and I having an hour-long discussion about when Jesus comes out, is that light that's lighting him, the only one that's backlighting him, is it red or is it white? And it was that kind of work that allowed this piece to become what it is.
Yeah, Daniel is really crucial. I know he's absent right now, but I mean, he's clearly, without Daniel, this play would not have existed. Yeah. And in that sense, he really works very selflessly with a lot of creators in Canada and does not get credited the way some of the other, you know, big Canadian directors do. He's truly a fabulous theater creator, and work, you know, as he says, he just agonizes over every moment, and that informs the design and the writing.
Yeah, it shows through. We hope we've given you some idea, listeners, of the scope of this show. It takes a satirical look. It's a look presented through the frame of the Mass. Now, that's the other thing we've got to get to. And Rick, you alluded to that you knew the Catholic liturgy inside out. And that gave you a frame to explore this question of, well, what about Jesus today?
I think Daniel in particular was very interested. Having grown up Jewish in a Catholic context, he was fascinated by this idea of liturgy taking up place inside our heads and what liturgy is in theater, in a secular space. So whereas my instinct was probably just to speak it as if, you know, I believe in God the Father Almighty, blah, 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 Daniel really wanted me to slow down and give it some weight and not attach any belief system to it, but just speak it as theater. And I came to realize that the Catholic Mass is truly fantastic theater, and not taking away from anyone's belief, it is valid in a theatrical space. And of course, from that framework, we branch off into many different directions, but that is kind of our grounding point throughout the whole play.
Beth, you had to shape this, did you? Of go to the occasional Mass as a Jew and get a feel for, you know, what the rhythm was.
No, actually, we didn't as designers go to Mass. Ben was raised Christian, so we had an idea of the church. I had been to a couple of Masses through weddings and funerals and stuff, so it was vaguely familiar. But there was a lot of research done. We watched a lot of videos and read quite a bit about the liturgy and researched historically too. When we tour, we go to a lot of churches. It's one of the things we like to do.
Because you can perform this. You don't need to be constricted to a theatre space to perform this necessarily, do you?
We tried performing it in a church. Technically, what you probably didn't see, what we've become masters at hiding, is all the little bits and pieces technically that make the show work, that give the show the magic. So actually, we do very much need to be in a theater
technically
space.
Sophisticated space.
Yeah, quite. Right. Because there's all kinds of little cameras hidden and rigging, and the lighting is really important, and the lighting plays off the cameras and vice versa. So it actually is really important where we are. And we work pretty hard as the caretakers of the show that we've created and been entrusted with to make sure that it looks and feels the same wherever we end up.
Well, let's talk about the way the show unfolds. It takes the frame of the mass. It walks us through a figure that starts off perhaps as the priest, if you go into the traditional mass, but takes on other characters, including Jesus, towards the end as we move towards the Eucharistic celebration. Our first character is Jewish. Our first character takes off as a Jewish introduction to the Bible. Other characters we meet are a revivalist, come tele-evangelist, who I think has probably got the message of the piece in there. A flight attendant's prayer diary, grappling with sins small and large. And Homer Simpson cast as Judas. Now, I think this is a masterstroke. In a sense, every man. There's no doubt that we're all part of this. And finally, the figure of Jesus crucified. This is a journey that is at once satirical and at another level serious. The question is, Rick, who is this targeting? Is it targeting Jesus, or is it targeting what we've done with Jesus?
You mean targeting in terms of theme, not audience,
yes,
right?
Yes, theme.
I think what... You know, I've had a lot of time to think about it and talk about it, especially in these talkbacks after the play. I try and see what emerges in audiences' minds. And what I feel, I'm delivering a kind of, I call it a cubist Jesus, in that we're looking at this phenomenon of Jesus, this crucified Jew from 2,000 years ago who is now an action figure and on crosses on mountains and such. We're looking at how he can be portrayed in all of these different facets, from a scholarly point of view to from a passionate, preachy point of view, from the more cosmic to the pop culture. We're trying to paint a portrait of how complex this is, and the satire is very much aimed at... It's geared towards reverence more than irreverence, I would say. What we're trying to realize is that we, as human beings, especially in modern culture, are very much often disconnected from each other. And religion and theater are two things that do establish deeper connections, even a kind of transcendence. And Daniel was very... And Daniel, Beth, and Ben, I would say, again, as she said, they're the caretakers of this. If ever I slip out and slip into something that's either too cute or too clever or too funny... You know, their job is to rein me back in and realize that, no, we're actually trying to create a kind of religious experience in the theater.
There's a line here, Ben, that you must be very careful about, isn't it? That you, if you get too broad, you're in danger of losing the audience completely.
Very much so, yeah. We intend to create an atmosphere. And part of the reason we don't have walkout music at the end, as an example, is... After he paints the sand image and says the final benediction, we're meant to just think on the theme that Christianity is bigger than Jesus.
And in many ways, the questions that hang off that are essentially about what Christianity has done with Jesus, not about Jesus himself, Beth.
Yeah, absolutely. Which the final words being going, go in peace and love and serve the Lord, and we've... Which connects back to the beginning when, you know, you're going to hear the word Lord, you're going to hear the word God and take that to mean whatever you need it or want it to mean, so that you get to leave the theater with that message that you just go in peace and love and be good to each other.
John Cleary with you. Our guests are Rick Miller, Beth Cates, and Ben Chasen, the team who've put together, along with the absent Daniel Brooks, who put together Bigger Than Jesus, a little theatre experience currently at the Sydney Festival. Let's talk for a moment about audience reaction, Rick. You do a remarkable thing. After an exhausting hour or so on stage, you quickly, like within a minute, appear outside in the foyer with the audience saying, "Well, folks, what do you think?" It's very brave.
I wouldn't say it's so much a what do you think. It is part of, I feel part of this experience is a post-show connection point again, working on a different level where I'm not so much playing characters, but I'm just myself. It is not because I really need validation. At this point, I know the play works. We've had great success with it. It's won some awards. It is really just, I know some people, for some people, this experience, and religion in particular, is a very emotional, sometimes difficult struggle. They often feel that they can't find what they want within the context of a church, and either they've rejected it, and yet sometimes there's a longing for some kind of transcendence. And this play, to some people, has a very powerful effect, and I like to be able to help discuss this after the play, not as a therapist in any way. It really is just to keep a discussion going, and it's not just me talking. It's often people relating, not just saying they like the play, but relating what their own experience was, what their own religious baggage is, and often connecting with each other.
What sort of responses do you get? I mean, well, have you got everything from sort of, you know, you're nothing but a satanic agent
generally
this
people
is the
who,
voice of God?
I'd say the people who feel that I'm a satanic agent either don't come to a play called Bigger Than Jesus, or as they did in Sydney, the first time ever in 8 years and 25 cities of doing this play, we had a protest outside on the first night. And, you know, it was a conservative Catholic group who had written already. We knew they were protesting. They called the police to say they were going to protest. Very calm, very mild in that sense. And they were praying for the soul of the people involved in this. And in that sense, we do get those reactions, but it's very rare. More often than not, we get people, for instance, there's a gentleman named Eric Stevenson from Australia, who is with a kind of progressive Christian organization called Freedom to Explore. And we, in every city, have had these connections to people doing similar things outside of a theater. And they are, you know, working with the historical Jesus, with the Jesus Seminar. They're really trying to struggle with these issues in a way that, to them, is not at all blasphemous, but it's still within the context of a kind of church-like community gathering, divorced again from dogma and doctrine. So I find the reactions are more often people like that who come up and say, this is great. And, you know, for anyone interested, there's a place where we do this kind of thinking all the time.
Beth and Ben, I saw the performance, and afterwards, the little interchange with the audience or the people who'd stayed around afterwards, you two were both at the back of the crowd sort of watching yourself. Have you ever caused to actually say, hang on, there was something there that a couple of those people said that was really interesting? I mean, do you feed off that as well?
It's come up occasionally. Those little, we used to call them chats with Jesus, came very naturally.
Let's have a little talk with.
But they came very naturally out of our first run of the show in Toronto, where there was one night where we had a rabbi, it's going to sound like a joke, a rabbi, a priest, and a mom, and one other person, and we had a small discussion, and
gathering
people were invited,
yeah.
Yeah, gathering at the bar. And then we thought, well, this is interesting, because people actually wanted to stay around and talk about it. And the times when we can get out and have be part of the conversation, often some of what we'll talk about is design. So we never pipe up from the background and challenge him, but not yet.
You occasionally have a word afterwards to say, hey, what that guy said.
Not really, no. We rarely participate in those. We really feel that the audience really wants to speak with Rick, and we're perfectly happy with that. We also have to clean up a lot of sand and action figures and writing on the floor, so we're quite busy at the end of the show.
But I do try and bring Beth and Ben in to at least make people acknowledge that despite the appearances of a solo show, show is very much a kind of a jazz sort of performance between, in this case, three people who are listening to each other's cues and really trying to just, again, play a kind of music.
Well, let me take a punt at what perhaps for me, I'll give you my version of what I thought the heart of the show was. It seemed to me the key line for me was uttered by your revivalist in the middle of his sermon. Quote, "You can think whatever the hell you want about an afterlife for your soul, but the hard fact of the matter is that your hot, sweaty body will get cold and start to rot, and if you haven't had any effect on anybody before you die, you certainly won't have any effect on anybody after you die."
Very, very nicely done, John. Are you asking if that's the heart of the play?
Yeah.
I would say you're pretty right on in terms of the preacher character, who is intentionally, whose voice emerged out of Daniel. I remember him saying this very clearly when we were about to open the play and we had a sermon, and I had written a kind of left of center sort of Rick Miller preachy sermon, and he said, "You have not earned the right to preach to the audience like that. Have some fun. Let yourself go." And Let Yourself Go emerged as this voice, that these voice of these American preachers who are so passionate and so free, and the job then was to infuse that voice with everything that is you're not expecting from the voice. And that contrast, some people don't get over the fact that it's a televangelist kind of voice, but other people really do hear the message that this is not a character who is tied to any organized religion. Is very much about being awake to ourselves, to other people, and having an effect. And this is one play where, you know, I sometimes do feel somewhat possessed of a mission. I really try and live that character and say, I am here to get some of you to wake up, truly. And it may sound very arrogant, and yet the arrogance and the humility of the play are also a heart of it. That contrast between this guy says he's bigger than Jesus. Well, that's not really what's happening. There's a humility through this that I think, I hope, shines through.
Ben and Beth, for you, the center, do you generally agree that sort of line is where you're coming from, essentially? What do you want people to take away from it, I guess?
I think it's that. I do think it's that. I think that was pretty keen of you to grasp onto. I think it's that because it's that message and it's that key there that we also take care of, because it's that fine line of this preacher going off and being too much, that we lose some of that. So yes, I think that's the message. I think that's what we want people to do. We want them to go out and take a little bit of the beauty and the kindness and the distillation of Jesus' words, or, you know, his purported words.
And if you're critical of anything, it seems to me that what you're intensely most critical of, if the play is taking a pot shot at anything, it's saying, look, be wary of the supernatural stuff, you know, because actually the more you look at Jesus, the more you see that whatever he thought, ultimately what he cared about was the here and now.
I completely agree, yeah. I think actually the teacher character sums it up best, that the world would be a safer place if Christians read their Bible with beautiful and inspiring liturgy. Literature, yeah. Rather, and that it's about dogma often comes out of a strict adherence to words translated that absolutely have no meaning. And Jesus himself spoke in parables, so how to not interpret everything in a book that's 2,000 years old as not parable is ridiculous. And I think that's sort of what we're saying, but that there is nothing wrong with having any faith in humanity and if you need a higher power.
On Sunday night, we're talking about Bigger Than Jesus, a play in Sydney for the Sydney Festival. Our guests are Rick Miller, co-creator and performer, Beth Cates, and Ben Chasen, who designed the show and make sure Rick gets to deliver it accurately and on time every day.
Christianity, ladies and gentlemen, that's our topic for today. It's time to set the record straight, to baptize you all in the Church of Rational Thought. Christianity, made up of Christians, followers of one Jesus of Nazareth, named Christ, by his apostles from the Greek Christos, which means anointed one. Let's say, for argument's sake, I'm Jesus. What do we know for certain about me? Well, first and foremost, I am Jewish. I am a Jew, which may come as a surprise to the 67% of Americans who think that I am a Christian. Wrong. I was born a Jew. I lived a Jew. I died a Jew. There is no evidence to show that I intended to found a new religion. In fact, Christianity was a Jewish sect until long after my death. What else do we know? Well, I was born into the peasant class sometime between 4 and 6 BC. Yes, Christ was born before Christ. Go figure. What else do we know? Well, from non-Christian sources, the only writer to even mention me in the first 100 years after my death is a Jewish historian by the name of Josephus. Here's what Josephus had to say about me. In 90 AD, he said that I was a wise man. I did startling things. I had a huge following. I came to Jerusalem, was arrested by the Romans, and crucified. That's it. Everything else we think we know about me comes from my followers. Christians, a very biased bunch to say the least, who over the course of 300 years put together a collection of writings known as the New Testament. The New Testament is a new and improved covenant with God that fulfills the old covenant with God, the Hebrew Bible, which Christians rearrange and call the Old Testament. The New Testament, or TNT as I like to call it, is made up of 27 books, including four which give accounts of my life and teachings. These are called the Gospels. And it is now known and agreed upon by Christian scholars, Christian archaeologists, other rational human beings who care to look at facts, that the Gospels were written between 40 and 70 years after my death. Let's be very clear about that. It is highly unlikely that a single one of these Gospel writers ever witnessed a single event of my life. The Gospels are pure heresy. Sorry, hearsay.
Let's talk about some of the framework you deal with. At the start, the Jewish Christianity 101 lecture introduces us to something that a lot of people who take theology seriously would have been familiar with for 100 years. But people who don't know much about the Bible go, "Ooh, I didn't know that." And this is the idea that the first books of the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are in fact written a few years after Jesus' death. And they're not written from one-to-one contact necessarily, but from 30 years distance, looking back. Now, you use this as a critique. You say that we can't view these as history. Many scholars would say, well, yeah, that's only true in part. But whilst they may be written by supporters of Jesus, they're still being given some historical credence. That is, where you can identify historic circumstances, they're usually pretty accurate.
I think the Jesus Seminar and people like John Dominic Crossan and Marcus,
who we had on the show last week.
Is that right? You know, I've certainly read a lot of their material, and I think they would agree in principle that one tends to disagree, and they even have debates as to did he say that, or was that written by... No, these kind of things are the subject of people's lifetimes of scholarly work. And what this teacher does is he frames it as, let me try telling a story. And the story that he's telling is very much based on what he wants to say. He is framing, he's telling the story of the history of anti-Semitism as developed through
I want to get onto that in a moment, because I want to deal with the anti-Semitism thing, but let's just stick with what's called the synoptic tradition, that is Matthew, Mark, Luke.
Yeah.
And the suggestion is that you can read some things as history, but these have to be read differently. My point is that even the Jesus Seminar would say, no, that some of this is historically reliable.
Oh, of course, but with any history, you know, a novel today will refer to historical events, and yet the novelist will have an agenda or an intention in this sense.
As every writer does.
Absolutely.
And every historian does.
Sure, and I wouldn't deny that Jesus did say a lot of what was said in the Sermon on the Mount, except when you're dealing with these documents... There, I don't think people back then, and I think the scholars would agree, their intention was not to write, in the case of the crucifixion, the police report. Really,
yes.
It was to convey a fiction based on a real person.
Or a story based on a real person. See,
yeah.
Again, it's the difficulty of pejorative language, isn't it? Any word you use, any adjective you use somebody will risk saying, that's pejorative language, and you get into all sorts of trouble. And,
like the word truth, which we talk about, a difficult word, right?
Indeed. And the other word which you have fun with is sin. Where do we talk about that? Well, let's talk about sin. I want to talk about one other difficulty before we talk about sin. Let's talk about anti-Semitism. You trace anti-Semitism back to the Gospel of John. Now, it is certainly true that in the Gospel of John, John is written many years after the other Gospels. By this time, the Romans have certainly buried the temple, and Judaism and Christianity have sort of separated in a way. And John is saying, look, the Jews are responsible for Jesus' death because he's got to keep in good with the Romans. And we can't have the Romans being responsible because they're in charge. Now, that's certainly true in John's Gospel, but anti-Semitism predates John's Gospel. I mean, the Greeks and the Romans were persecutors of the Jews over various times. So it's...
It's a far trickier story than we're allowed to elaborate on in 10 minutes. For instance, we don't mention Paul, the Apostle Paul, who was a great factor in the growth of Christianity, and partly because we tried throwing Paul in there, and it was confusing because of the Beatles reference, right? So, and I remember that point where Daniel said, wait a minute, people are going to get lost. And so we had to simplify, and in so doing, we're not telling the whole story. We're not even telling the truth specifically, because the truth is so much up for grabs. What we are trying to do at least a little bit is to, as Ben said before, to say that, okay, if you look at this as literature, it does not take away from a lot of its value. If anything, it enhances its value for me. And so one shouldn't be afraid of doing that. And once you do that, once you clear away and call it literature or myth even, then the rest of the play is a bit of a reassembling of my own, our own personal Jesus story. And so I think there's value in sort of clearing the slate a little bit. And we have a very white stage for that part of the play. For that reason, it's sort of a, okay, here's what we think we know, and the rest is invented probably.
But Beth, why the anti-Semitism streak so strongly? Because the play definitely says Christianity is responsible for anti-Semitism.
We do, don't we?
I wouldn't say that's a message of the play.
But why bother to say it?
Well, look, we have that image, right, of Jesus in the Kaddish, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe you should mention that moment, because it's a crucified Jewish man in the end, in a kind of pieta. And you know the Kaddish. I didn't actually know the piece, right?
So maybe just... So at the end, after when Jesus is actually heading to his crucifixion, and it's funny because I always see you at that point as Mary, bringing the body.
Right.
So he's disrobed, he's taken the wig off, and so imagistically we have this pieta, which is a very familiar image to everyone. And that was a discussion I remember about, what are you going to sing? And we decided to sing the Kaddish, which is the Jewish prayer of mourning. And we have quite a beautiful version of it playing. So in that way, I don't know that we continue the line of anti-Semitism through anything. I mean, he does say pretty clearly, well, if I had time, we could talk about this, but just know that it's part of the conflicted history. And here I am as a stereotypical Jewish New Yorker standing on this white stage telling you, yeah, it's a problem. And you can deal with it in the next seminar.
There's a quote that we talk about where the teacher says right off the bat that 67% of Americans think Jesus was a Christian, not a Jew. And so we're trying to not hammer home, but we're trying to have one character that says the guy was Jewish.
Yeah, recover the something.
And he ends Jewish. There's a Jewish son who died in his mother's arms. It's a human story in that sense. It's not a supernatural story in our portrayal. And we're not trying to hammer home anti-Semitism. Again, that's one character. And often the characters contradict each other in ways that, again, paint a very...
Yes. Allow the characters their reality.
Yes. Yes.
Their perceptions. Let's talk then about the great one, S-I-N. And as you so carefully do, remove the S, get rid of the N, and what have we got? I in the middle. Now, you treat I in a very positive way. And what you suggest is that sin, in fact, demeans the role of I, the our responsibility, this concept of sin. Are you saying that the word sin itself is problematic, or are you saying there is that we are, as individuals, actually... we were born pretty okay, actually. You know, we don't need to worry about that sort of stuff. We can just make up our own minds and she'll be right, mate. She's a great Australian.
My mother, who is a devout Catholic, she had a baby, and I mentioned this at the beginning of the play in the framework. She had a child before I was born who died unbaptized. And because of her beliefs, and even though the Vatican had abolished limbo soon after that moment, she spent her life feeling that this child... is born with original sin, was never cleansed and baptized, and hence lives in this strange netherworld called limbo. And that guilt haunted her whole life. And that makes me so angry. And in that sense, we're trying to steal that word sin away and to say that a baby coming out of a mother's womb, and the preacher goes pretty graphically into that, but he says, look, this is not a baby with a genetic defect. This is a beautiful, if anything, more empathic, loving, needy creature than all of us. How can you possibly dare to say this kid is a sinner and needs to be cleansed by someone throwing water on his head. Again, that's that character's story, and it comes out of anger. I wouldn't say I necessarily share that, but that's what comes across.
Because there is even if we're uncomfortable with a word like sin, there is nevertheless, even modern writers have tried to come to terms with what Arthur Koestler famously called the ghost in the machine, mm-hmm. or even Richard Dawkins calls the selfish gene. That is, mm-hmm. if we're not careful, there is something here that leads us down a path which isn't very productive, mm-hmm. and that we have to be aware of that. I mean, sin is not just a Christian concept. It's there in most religious traditions, that somehow we have a bent that will lead us off track. How comfortable were you, or are you, in saying that, and it appears that one of your characters is saying that, look, if we just take responsibility for ourselves, she'll be right, mate.
Well, I don't know what you guys feel about it, but going through that every day, I sort of make it clear that if you divorce sin from an inherited religious tradition word, and you truly live according to your own values, in that sense, and I'm quoting from a book from a supporter of mine named Greta Vosper, who is progressive Christianity woman. The subtitle of her book, With or Without God, is Why How You Live is Far More Important Than What You Believe. And how you live, wherever your morality comes from, in my case, it comes from my gut instinct and my general compassion for others, and that guides my life.
Where do we get our morality from, I guess, is the question that underlines this too, Beth, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's
you wrote
a
another
tough one
play kind of
about the morality. Yeah, well, and that's the eye that we referred to isn't the apple eye, right? It's not the selfish eye. It's not the popular culture eye. It's the truth within you, which isn't just a matter of like just sit back and you'll be all right, mate. It's a matter of actually looking within and finding your morality, and not just letting it go, not just be playing it easy.
Yeah.
It's not work, which the preacher is pretty clear about. It's not just sitting back on your haunches.
And he doesn't end with the eye. He ends with the pass eye on, which is a bit of a cliched breaking down of passion, right? But he can get away with that kind of thing. Yeah. His whole message, and he ends repeating it three times right before his hallelujah, is pass eye on. And it's not so much about being narcissistic, and it's all about the I. If anything, it is the opposite of that. It's being self-confident enough to be able to connect in a deep way with other people in a culture that drives us into ourselves with such superficial vanity. You know, marketing is all about everything you deserve, you get right now, despite what everyone else thinks. It's the opposite of that selfishness. And Dawkins would say the same thing, I would say. His vision of the selfish gene is not... Yes, we are born with certain selfish survival instincts, and yet his sense of God and of wonder and of compassion is more of an Einstein sort of embracing or getting rid of the delusion of the self and embracing a larger compassionate humanity. And I think the preacher tries to bust through that.
On Sunday night, we're talking about Bigger Than Jesus. We're talking with Rick Miller, Beth Cates, and Ben Chasen about Bigger Than Jesus, a play that's been part of the Sydney Festival and a worldwide success for this small Toronto-based ensemble. It's good to have you with us. Now, you know, I put you through the ringer just before that piece of music. Let's talk about some of the sort of ideals we have for this message, because it's been successful around the world. What do you think, Ben, as you've travelled with it and looked at it, has been the key to the success?
I think it's mainly that it's a universal simple message, and admittedly we've gone to Christian countries, generally speaking Christian countries. We've not played Iran, though we've been asked. We've not played Pakistan, you know.
Although Jerusalem has asked us to come there, right?
True, yeah,
yeah, that is really
interesting.
What do you think it is that's got its appeal?
I think that, I mean, we're not standing up there and saying this is the way, this is right, this is wrong. you're going to believe this by the time you're done the play, or you're not. And it, nobody's standing up there with any answers because we don't have them. We're four little theater people from Canada. You know, we're not going to have the big answer, as no one really does.
Do you think it's also because for the first time, people who sit in the pews, this is the first generation in which they've been able to say, hang on, I don't necessarily accept what's coming out of there. I've read this book and I can read that book. So people are asking these questions themselves and have now for a generation. So they're comfortable enough now to wrestle with it publicly. It's no longer a private question, which they've just got to have these serious doubts about.
Yeah,
we've tapped into something that always surprises me. And not just a generation, I'd say even older than mine. My mother's generation, my mother who's 73, was not allowed at all to delve into this stuff. And she knows that I am. And she may wish the play would go away sometimes because she worries about it. And yet we've tapped into a whole people who no longer go to church generally. And yet still they find, as Ben said, a humanity, a common humanity, as even a secular mass has this appeal. You know, it's a strange thing, but I feel we've tapped into it. And the post-show discussions only reinforced that for me. That some people, this stuff is really potent. And, you know, I'm delighted to feel that we found with our little humble play, which is, you know, deeply constructed, but it's still just a play. And somehow we're delving into something deeper.
Do you think it also gets back to the question we touched on earlier, that somehow people might have moved away from the church, but they still deep down recognize a need for some sort of value set. And there are still things in there, ethical values in the tradition that are really important to them, and that they want to know how to wrestle with those?
Yeah, I've had that conversation with more than a few people, including one woman who wrote a thesis on the play, who is a Catholic and a practicing Catholic, she's maybe 26 or 27. And her first response to the show that she then saw about seven times was that this is the Catholic Church that she wants. The ability to question and to worship and to be faithful and to believe in something and be able to carry that through her life.
And to carry some of those elements lightly. We had a Catholic priest on the program a few weeks ago, and somebody said to him about faith in God, you know, and he said, well, you know, I believe that. That's not a fact I can prove. It's something I believe. Mm-hmm. And that we're now actually coming to terms with that notion that somehow this is, all of us are engaged in this little journey of faith in some ways. And the reason I want to get to that at this stage is it takes us to the back end of your play, the climax of the play, where we actually focus down on the burden that Jesus is carrying. And in a sense, the burden that Jesus is carrying is the burden of history.
Mm-hmm. I think one of those key moments that we tend to feel is the heart of a play is Jesus standing there in our mass. He doesn't just appear symbolically. He gets, you know, 15 minutes in a spotlight with a clock ticking, knowing that the third cock crow will come soon and he has to go.
And through this, we're in the Last Supper, and all those icons of the Last Supper, the disciples, are the characters that we've made gods of. Everything from, sort of, as I said, Homer Simpson as Jesus to Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader. I thought that was
Martin Luther King and Gandhi. They're all somehow linked to Jesus. And yet Jesus says quite simply, you know, Christ was used. Christ is being used right now. Christ will be used again. And that's fine, I guess. You know, that sort of sentiment is very much that Jesus has been used and abused, name, image, call it a corporate logo, for all of these years, for good, sometimes for ill. And that's an undeniable fact of history. And what would Jesus say? Well, my Jesus, our Jesus, he sort of makes a bit of an absurd clown piece out of it, because I just threw on a wig and a robe, and all of a sudden you think I'm Jesus? This is a very strange moment in theater.
There's a great Canadian tradition there, of course. Jesus of Montreal was
which is a great
clown
film.
Figure.
Yeah, and you know, it's obviously touchy with a lot of people, and a lot of these people who are offended by the play. And we had this guy, this Christian fundamentalist who from Texas, who, you know, this guy who wanted to talk to me after the play, and people were afraid he was going to shoot me. It was a big guy, and he came up after, and he said, he talked to me alone. He didn't want anyone to hear, and he said, I just want to just say I'm a Christian fundamentalist. I really liked your play. I didn't find it funny, and he squeezed me really tight, but I really liked your play. And he went on to say he wished he could bring it down to Texas, but I'd get my head taken off. And there are a lot of people around the world who feel that way. They wish we could bring this play, which speaks deeply to, but he can't because we're risking our lives because of people's, you know, fervent beliefs.
Be careful what you believe. And also be committed to what you believe. Look, it's been great to have you all with us. Thanks so much for giving your time. Where to next? I mean, where does the play go? And is there another play in the offing?
Well, the next run of the play will be a remount in Toronto about 5 or 6 years after we played it last time. And then we're taking it to New York, which is exciting, as well as probably another run in Montreal. So, you know, pretty close to home. The goal eventually, and there's a documentary crew who really wants to take the show and film a touring documentary leading up to Jerusalem. And I think it would be a fantastic show in Jerusalem. It'd be a nice story for the documentary as well, because it follows, you know, the kind of Jesus story into Jerusalem. But I still think 1 year we're going to get there. And maybe that's the metaphor, right? We're all on our road to Jerusalem.
Next year, Jerusalem.
Exactly.
That's right.
Happy Passover.
Ben Chasen, Beth Cates, Rick Miller. Bigger than Jesus? Well, we'll leave it to you, the audience, to judge when you get along to see the play. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday night. It's been great to have you with us. And we'll go out with another piece of music, appropriately suggested, Tennessee Ernie Ford.
While passing through this world of sin, and others your life shall view, be clean and pure without within. Let others see Jesus in you. Let others see Jesus in you. Let others see Jesus in you. Keep telling the story, be faithful and true. Let others see Jesus in you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.